Welcome to the Intuitive Awakening Podcast. I'm your host, Deanna Riddick. I'm an author, teacher, and eternal seeker of truth. I am on a mission to spread metaphysical knowledge to help you awaken your spirit. If you want to learn how to open the door to your divine self, you are in the right place. In 1919, President Woodrow Wilson found himself in an unusual situation during a session before Congress. As he reached into his pocket, he accidentally dropped a small piece of red cloth. As the room fell silent, Wilson quickly explained that it was his conjure bag, something he carried with him to help with his rheumatism and with his other ailments. His nonchalant admission about this conjure bag spark curiosity, especially considering the world of hoodoo. Hoodoo is the African-American spiritual and magical tradition that had been influencing many people, even those in high office. So this brings us to the fascinating topic of hoodoo today. Hoodoo is a product of centuries of cultural exchange. Born out of African spiritual knowledge, it was shaped by Native American and European influences, each contributing their unique worldviews, folklore, and remedies. But when did hoodoo begin? While the exact origins remain unclear, it likely took root when indigenous Americans, Europeans, and enslaved Africans began to interact, blending their knowledge of spirituality and plant-based healing practices. In the practice of hoodoo, magic comes from roots, stones, bones, and even discharge from the human body, such as blood and sweat. By combining their power, you're able to tap into the force it produces and channel it to deliver the results that you want. In hoodoo, there's an understanding that there are spirits constantly around us, and those spirits can either serve or harm, depending on how you treat them. When African slaves were brought to North America, they were not allowed to practice their spiritual beliefs. Slaves were forcibly baptized into Christianity, either Catholicism or Protestantism, depending on their owners. Slaves had to hide their beliefs under the veil of Christianity. Enslaved people often blended their African spiritual beliefs with Christianity, creating new syncretic practices. For example, they might associate African deities with the Christian saints, allowing them to worship in a way that felt safer and more acceptable to their oppressors. As mentioned before, enslaved Africans often had to conceal their spiritual practices and their religious beliefs due to the oppressive conditions imposed by slave owners and the broader society, which really sought to suppress all African traditions. Enslaved individuals often held clandestine meetings to practice their rituals, to pray, and share their spiritual teachings. And these gatherings could take place in hidden locations, such as in the woods or basements, really away from the watchful eyes of the slave owners. They use symbols and they use codes in their practices to communicate and to signify their beliefs. For instance, certain colors, certain objects, or even certain gestures might carry hidden meanings known only to the practitioners. Spiritual teachings and rituals were often passed down orally, which helped preserve traditions without leaving written records that could be discovered by slave owners. But I also want to have a caveat here because most enslaved people didn't know how to read or write. We know that there are obviously cases in history where this occurs, but not that often. So for enslaved Africans, hoodoo offered a sense of control and cultural continuity in a brutal system of oppression. Now, hoodoo is not to be confused with Vodun. While they both have roots in Central Africa, they're very different practices. Vodun is a religion primarily practiced in Haiti. Now, there's a similar but very distinct practice called voodoo in Louisiana that many of you who've visited New Orleans at least, or even all of Louisiana, you're probably quite familiar with. Now, practitioners of both forms of, let's just say, Vodou, Vodun, they serve the Lawa, powerful spirits believed to control the physical world. Haitian Vodou or Vodun is more like a religion where there are, I believe, initiated priests and congregants. Hoodoo is not a religion. And the worship and the service to the Lawa is not a part of it. So I just wanted to kind of make those distinctions because even when I'm doing this episode today, you'll probably hear me use hoodoo interchangeably, and I'll explain that later on why I'm doing that, but it is distinct, just FYI. So how does hoodoo work? A lot of hoodoo practices, they've been passed down orally from generation to generation. There are no formal initiations, at least I am not aware of any. I'm not a practitioner, but from my knowledge, there aren't any very specific formal initiations like you would have if it was like Vodun. And each practitioner, they're taught practices by their family, or they end up developing their own practices and their beliefs. Some of the key elements include the use of herbs and roots, the use of candles, the use of powders, and the use of rituals and the connection to the land. And yes, there are many Christian elements tied into hoodoo, which we can kind of get into a little bit later. But as I spoke about earlier, a lot of enslaved Africans really were not allowed to practice their beliefs at all, so they had to practice them under the veil of Christianity and to be safe, if you will. So you have some syncretism there. Now, when I met my step grandmother many years ago, she's a minister. She would speak to me and my sisters when we were younger about people who would, put roots on you. You better behave, or you better not interact with that person. She's going to work roots on you. And I remember hearing about this when I was younger. Had no clue what working roots was. I just knew that obviously it had to be something devilish and demonic, right? I think if you're around my age, if you grew up like in the 1980s, even 70s, 60s, I would say you probably, and you lived in the South, or even I guess you could say Northeast, you probably have heard of root work in some capacity. And of course, its affiliation with being very dark, demonic, the devil. And we'll talk about why that is as well. But it's commonly understood that working roots is a harmful act towards you. There were even times where my father would use the same phrase to imply that somebody was hexing you, or somebody, was going to curse you in a dark way and league with the devil, right? They're going to work roots on you. I remember distinctly making the association of darkness, evil with working roots. But I never got more information than that. I don't think anybody actually understood the practice itself, but just given how hoodoo has been demonized and vilified through time, it's you become indoctrinated into that belief system that, of course, African practices are evil, which they're not. Okay, just to add a little bit, because I think it warrants mentioning here, root work is a major component of hoodoo, right? So whenever somebody practices hoodoo, they're going to practice root work, and we'll talk about what that means. However, in the media and in literature, which of course also stems from a history of racism and attempts to demonize African spiritual practices, root work was a part of that. And that's why you see in a lot of movies, a lot of books, and a lot of shows, if you have this dark, evil practitioner, using, I'll just say as an example, like a voodoo doll or something, or having candles, a voodoo doll, etc., that it's all understood that they're in connection with the devil and they're going to do some harmful acts towards you or somebody else, even though hoodoo has nothing to do really with the voodoo dolls that we see today. But all of it's conflated, of course. So, according to Anjali Berard, and if you are into hoodoo, then you know who she is. I would say over the past 5 to 6 years, her books have kind of exploded, and she's got great great recipes for root work for all types of occasions in your life. And she's got a great compendium of everything related to root work and hoodoo, which I absolutely love. And I completely refer you to her if you are interested in anything related to hoodoo. But according to her, the practice we know as hoodoo, it was originally termed root work. So again, we're going to see some of these terms conflated, right? Or used interchangeably, essentially. So we'll see root work, we'll see hoodoo. We will also see voodoo in some respects, which we'll talk about shortly why that is. But we'll also see conjure, and we'll talk about that as well. So if you've heard any of these terms, they're usually utilized to imply the same thing, like all under the guise of hoodoo, which again is considered to be evil. So root work is the practice of using herbs, roots, and natural materials to create charms, spells, and remedies, which really rely on the earth's resources to tap into their inherent magical properties. It's really a fascinating intersection of history, culture, and belief, showing just how these deeply, these traditions have woven themselves into American life. I would say also that in root work, it's understood that, again, roots and herbs have magical and healing powers, which of course they have healing powers. But in root work, these plants really do serve as a vital link between our minds, our bodies, and spirits, and it enables the practitioners to harness their very unique energies. Certain plants possess the remarkable ability to pierce the veil between our world and the spirit realm, granting access to wisdom and even guidance from the other side. So through these connections, individuals can seek answers to their pressing problems and invoke the spirits for assistance. Now, root work, it encompasses a wide array of magical applications. Some roots are known to attract love or luck, while others offer protection from harm or they ward off unwanted influences. And there are roots that are specifically used to, let's say as an example, aid in securing employment or promotions, as well as those roots that are intended for spiritual cleansing and purifying one's home. So as a technique within the broader practice of conjure, we'll talk about that in a minute, root work often focuses on providing security and safeguarding against violence. Interestingly, those in positions of authority, such as law enforcement and judges, who are supposedly like confounded by these magical practices, are said to be rooted, highlighting the powerful influence of this tradition. During slavery, many enslaved Africans served as community doctors, offering medical care to both Black and white people, despite widespread skepticism from white community. This caution was partly due to the fear that some enslaved Africans used their knowledge of herbal remedies for harmful purposes, including poisoning their masters. However, enslaved Africans also used their extensive knowledge of herbal medicine to really treat a variety of ailments and diseases, which benefited both Black, the Black communities and the white communities alike. So one notable example in history comes from the story of Cotton Mather and Onesimus, who was an enslaved African in colonial Boston, and he was held in bondage to the Puritan minister who was called Cotton Mather. I'm going to stop here though, because I think if you hear that name Cotton Mather, and if you know your history of the United States, especially in Massachusetts, you know, oh no, is this the same Cotton Mather who was involved in the Salem witch trials? Yes, you're absolutely correct. So I just wanted to interject and put that in there, because this is the same Cotton Mather that we're referring to. That name is very unique, and I don't think anybody doesn't know that name. Okay, so anyway, let's get back to the story. So, you know, at this time, with Cotton Mather and his slave Onesimus, they were in Boston, and Boston had experienced repeated smallpox outbreaks since the 1690s. Onesimus actually introduced the practice of inoculation to Mather, which helped reduce the spread of smallpox in the colony. Onesimus shared that in Africa, people practiced inoculation to protect themselves from disease, a practice that, of course, proved invaluable during the epidemic. Similarly, an enslaved man who discovered a cure for a snake bite using herbal medicines, he was granted his freedom. Jane Minor, an enslaved woman in Virginia, was emancipated for her medical expertise during an 1825 fever epidemic, and she went on to run her own hospital, eventually using her earnings to free at least 16 slaves. So you have some stories there as well. Enslaved Africans most often treated their own medical issues, relying on the herbal knowledge that they brought from Africa, as well as using some of the indigenous herbal practices that they learned from the Native Americans. Many slaveholders, lacking knowledge themselves, or showing little concern for their slaves' health, often allowed or even encouraged enslaved people to treat their own ailments. However, as you'll see later, there were laws passed eventually to prevent enslaved Africans from providing medical care. And this was essentially fueled by the fear that slaves could poison their masters with their herbal remedies or concoctions. Enslaved women in particular used their knowledge of herbs to induce miscarriages and prevent children from being born into slavery. Plants such as pennyroyal and senna, they were commonly used for this purpose in the 19th century. And these practices in particular were often seen as forms of resistance against the dehumanizing institution of slavery. Many enslaved Africans and freed Blacks also only trusted their own community healers rather than going to white doctors. And this again is partly because their herbal treatments that were provided by the enslaved Africans or by the free Blacks were often more effective than those prescribed by white physicians. These herb doctors, which were often referred to as root doctors or practitioners of hoodoo, they played a central role in the health of enslaved communities. Some also practiced conjure, which is blending spiritual and herbal knowledge in their healing practices. The integration of African, indigenous, and European herbal knowledge further enriched the healing traditions of Africans. George Washington Carver, who was an agricultural scientist, he was referred to as a root doctor, which you probably never hear, but he was referred to as a root doctor by the Black communities because of his extensive knowledge of plants and their medicinal uses. And likewise, Jim Jordan, who was the son of former slaves in North Carolina, learned hoodoo and conjure from his family. As a skilled practitioner of root work, he built a thriving business healing his clients with his knowledge of plants as well. So as I stated earlier, in 1748, Virginia passed a law to prevent Africans from administering medicine because white Americans feared that Black folk practitioners would poison them with their remedies. However, some white Americans continue to rely on African herbal doctors because, again, their cures were quite a bit better. And in addition, in 1749 in South Carolina, the General Assembly passed a law prohibiting slaves from practicing medicine or dispensing medication, and it was punishable by death if you were caught doing so. Slaveholders feared a possible slave revolt by being poisoned by their slaves en masse. They feared it so much so that white Americans refused to allow enslaved Africans medical knowledge. Many of the medicines that were used by white Americans were chemical, while Africans used natural herbs and roots and made them into teas. So let's talk a little bit more now about conjure. Conjure, in the context of American hoodoo, refers to a system of folk magic, spiritual practices, and beliefs that emerged in the African American community, particularly among enslaved Africans and their descendants in the South. This practice combines African traditions with the elements from European, Native American, and other spiritual practices to create a syncretic form of resistance and survival. Conjure involves the use of herbs, roots, charms, rituals, and spells to influence events to protect somebody or to protect yourself or resist oppression. In the history of enslavement, hoodoo and conjure served as a powerful tool, or both of them served, I would say, as powerful tools for resistance against the dehumanizing conditions of slavery and racial oppression. For enslaved individuals, these practices were not just forms of personal protection, but also subversive acts that aimed to undermine the authority of enslavers and to create alternative forms of empowerment. Conjure was a pragmatic response to the harsh realities of slavery. Enslaved people had very few resources to fight back against their enslavement in physical or, of course, legal terms. However, Conjure offered them a spiritual and psychological tool to reclaim some form of power and control in their lives. It gave them a way to influence their environment, protect themselves from physical harm, and even seek justice in a system that was inherently unjust. Many enslaved people didn't have the luxury of open rebellion. Conjure, therefore, allowed them to subtly challenge the oppressive system without direct confrontation, which obviously could be met with brutal retaliation. It became a realistic way to exert influence over their circumstances when physical rebellion wasn't always going to be feasible. Conjure was an integral part of enslaved people's strategies of resistance because it provided a way for individuals to counter the oppressive forces that sought to control them. Through rituals, spells, and through magical practices, enslaved individuals could curse or hex enslavers, or those who perpetuated the system of slavery, place protective charms or spells to safeguard themselves and their loved ones from physical harm or punishment, and use spiritual guidance and ritual to maintain hope, resilience, and a sense of community, which were crucial in maintaining their spirits under the conditions of slavery. These practices were not only personal, but also collective, as communities of enslaved people often engaged in conjure together, strengthening their communal bonds and shared resistance. Conjure was often used in subtle but powerful subversive activities, such as undermining the authority of enslavers by performing rituals that were believed to weaken or harm the oppressor's power, using supernatural practices to disrupt the order of things, like causing misfortune, sickness, or chaos in the lives of enslavers. Resisting exploitation and control by ensuring that they could gain some form of autonomy over their lives and circumstances, even if it was only on a small scale. The use of conjure was also an act of defiance. By engaging in magical practices, enslaved people were sending a message that they refused to be totally controlled or broken by the system. Conjure offered alternative possibilities for empowerment in a system that was designed to disempower. While enslaved people were stripped of many rights and privileges, conjure allowed them to draw on spiritual and ancestral resources to reclaim some form of power over their lives, challenge the material and psychic violence of enslavement by asserting an alternative form of resistance through spiritual means, reconnect with ancestral knowledge and practices that provided strength and direction in the face of brutality. Conjure allowed for an empowered existence in an otherwise powerless position. Even though enslaved people were physically confined, they could still access spiritual realms where they had more control, offering them a form of inner liberation. In an effort to control and maintain the structure of slavery, King Louis XIV of France issued the Code Noir. Although the code didn't solely target enslaved people's religious beliefs, or spiritual beliefs, let's just say that, it was part of a broader system aimed at suppressing any practices that might challenge authority or even unify the enslaved. The primary purpose of the Code Noir was to regulate the behavior and treatment of enslaved people. It outlined the kinds of work they were expected to perform and the punishments they would face for their disobedience. The goal was to ensure the continuation of the slave economy. It was to prevent uprisings and to maintain order within the colonies. While the Code Noir didn't specifically outlaw African spiritual practices, it mandated the conversion of enslaved Africans to Catholicism. The French viewed Christianity as a tool for moral control, right? Believing that converting enslaved people would make them more docile and easier to manage. This effort to replace African religions was driven by the belief that enslaved people's spiritual beliefs could challenge the colonial order, and it needed to be replaced with the Catholic doctrine. Many enslaved Africans in the French colonies came from diverse cultural backgrounds, bringing with them a variety of religious beliefs, languages, and traditions. These spiritual practices often linked to ancestral worship and vodun in some cases. They were seen as a form of resistance. There was a deep fear that these belief systems could unite enslaved people, fostering collective action that might lead to rebellion, as seen in the Haitian Rebellion or Haitian Revolution. I believe it was 1791 to 1804, when enslaved people successfully overthrew their oppressors. The Code Noir sought to replace African spiritual practices with Catholicism. Though it didn't explicitly outlaw African religions, again, the fear was that the practices like rituals or charms and healing, which would evolve into practices like hoodoo and eventually voodoo, they could undermine the authority of the colonizers. These practices were seen as a means of resistance, enabling enslaved people to heal, to protect, and even empower themselves. Many enslaved people continued to practice these traditions covertly, blending them with Catholicism in a very syncretic way, which ended up giving rise to traditions like Louisiana voodoo. Despite the efforts of colonizers and slave owners to suppress African spiritual practices, these traditions clearly persisted. In fact, we know that Frederick Douglass himself was a recipient of voodoo. And many of you probably have heard this story, but I figured I would recount it here for you guys. Frederick Douglass, who was a former slave in Maryland and a national leader of the abolitionist movement, has his own story of hoodoo, which he writes about in his autobiography. So in his autobiography, he writes that he sought spiritual assistance from an enslaved conjurer named Sandy Jenkins. Sandy told Douglass to follow him into the woods, where they found a root that Sandy told Douglass to carry in his right pocket to prevent any white man from whipping him. Douglass carried the root on his right side as instructed by Sandy, and he hoped that the root would work when he returned to the plantation. So the cruel slave owner, or let's just call him the slave breaker in this instance, Mr. Covey tells Douglass to do some work. But as Mr. Covey approached Douglass, Douglass had the strength and the courage to resist Mr. Covey and defeated him after they fought. Covey never bothered Douglass again. So in his autobiography, Douglass believes that the root that he was given by the conjurer, Sandy, he believes that it prevented him from being whipped by the slave. Can we call him slave breaker? Overseer, maybe? Anyway, he believed that it worked and it was super effective. So he was no longer being whipped by Mr. Covey. So that's one interesting story of hoodoo from Frederick Douglass. Next, we'll talk about Bishop Jameson. Bishop Jameson, born enslaved in Georgia in 1848, wrote an autobiographical account of his life. He writes that on a plantation in Georgia, there was an enslaved hoodoo man named Uncle Charles Hall who prescribed herbs and charms for slaves to protect themselves from white people. Hall instructed the slaves to anoint roots 3 times daily and to chew and spit the roots towards their enslavers for protection. Another slave story talks about an enslaved woman who's named Old Julie, and she was a conjure woman who was known amongst the slaves on the plantation for conjuring death. Old Julie conjured so much death that her slaveholder sold her away to stop her from killing people on the plantation with conjure. Her enslaver put her on a steamboat to take her to the new slaveholder in the Deep South. According to the stories of freedmen after the Civil War, Old Julie used her conjure powers to turn the steamboat back to where it was docked, forcing her slaveholder who tried to sell her to keep her. In the early 20th century, the practice of traditional healing and conjure was frequently looked on as foolish superstition by those outside of the African American community in the Mid-South. Traditional practices that had been performed for years were often mocked in the public eye. Hoodoo was commonly vilified in the Deep South, and it was deemed witchcraft, devil worship, and it was frequently used as a pejorative term to describe this spiritual practice, which contains a distinct lineage in North America. Many outsiders of Hoodoo culture showed anger, disgust, contempt, and confusion when encountering the Hoodoo culture. Southerners often conflated Hoodoo and voodoo, using these terms interchangeably to describe African-American healing and spiritual practices. New Orleans seems to set the stage for paranoia and fear of root work and conjure in the Mid-South. New Orleans was looked on as the mecca of hoodoo and voodoo. Media reports seldom accurately describe the African diaspora in Louisiana. Instead, they confused or sensationalized reports of animal and human sacrifices, zombies and curses, etc. The potential for African religions to bond to its devotees were often feared by slave owners, and in some cases, practitioners were punished for merely practicing traditions. One newspaper reports that 15 Negro men and women were arrested in New Orleans last week for participating in the African voodoo dance. When taken, they had images pacing around the room, as is the custom in Africa. The dance is most obscene and brutal, and they were ordered 50 lashes each. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, national newspapers published sensationalized headlines such as secrets of vicious voodoo doctors who victimized their gullible girls and the voodoo boogeyman, which played a significant role in spreading fear and misunderstanding of hoodoo. An autobiographical account from Reverend Irving E. Lowry, which was written in 1911, sheds light on one such incident that I think contributed to the growing fear surrounding African spiritual practices. Born enslaved in Sumter County, South Carolina in 1850, Lowry recalled a rumor about an enslaved woman named Mary on the Frierson plantation who was believed to have died from conjure. It was rumored that an enslaved woman named Epsie from a neighboring plantation poisoned Mary out of jealousy, as Mary had caught the attention of a man on another plantation whom Epsie was romantically interested in. According to Lowry's account, Epsie had obtained poison from an enslaved conjurer and secretly administered it to Mary, who died 6 months later. Lowry also noted that many of the conjure practices in Sumter County were influenced by voodoo or vodun from West Africa. This only fueled the growing fear and suspicion of hoodoo during this time. I'm sure you might be wondering about the relationship between hoodoo in the South and even, you know, in Black churches, which is something I really wanted to talk about today. So I think the tension between Black churches and hoodoo, particularly in the context of the African-American community, of course, is deeply rooted in the history of religious and cultural practices. To understand this, it's really important to consider both the influence of Christianity and the complex cultural dynamics of Black communities in the U.S. Christianity, in particular, in its evangelical and Protestant forms, tends to discourage practices that don't align with its doctrines, which include folk magic, spirit work, and other forms of African-derived spiritual practices like hoodoo. Black churches, which were often rooted in evangelical Christian traditions, they viewed hoodoo as a form of paganism or superstition, which was incompatible with the worship of the Christian God. This disapproval extended to many of the African religious practices that had been blended into hoodoo as a way of preserving ancestral beliefs in the face of slavery and colonialism. For many Black people, the adoption of Christianity was a way of coping with the trauma and oppression of slavery and even segregation. Christian churches offered a sense of community, spiritual uplift, and resistance against the harsh realities of life under white supremacy. This often involved the rejection or suppression of African traditions, including hoodoo, in favor of a more respectable and civilized form of worship. Obviously, I'm putting air quotes around those words. As a result, Black churches might have viewed hoodoo as a reminder of an earlier so-called less sophisticated, again, quotes, less sophisticated time that was associated with slavery and the perceived backwardness of African traditions. Hoodoo, with its emphasis on magical and spiritual powers, such as charms, conjuring, and using objects or herbs for healing or protection, it was seen as a threat to the authority of the church and its spiritual leadership. Many Black preachers, like their white counterparts, they were concerned that hoodoo might lead people away from the teachings of the Bible, as it emphasized a different way of interacting with the world and with the divine. Church leaders, they might have feared that the reliance on hoodoo could undermine the moral and spiritual authority of the church, especially if it was seen as an alternative source of power. Black churches also played a significant role in the fight for social respectability and dignity in a racially segregated society. As African Americans navigated a world of deep racial discrimination, their churches became institutions of pride, which promoted values that aligned with mainstream Christian ideals. Hoodoo, which was often associated with the rural, working class, and sometimes even criminal elements, long story there, it might have been seen as something that could diminish the social status of churchgoers or even the church itself. While some Black individuals may have been raised with hoodoo, there were generational and regional differences in how Black communities engaged with these traditions. In urban areas or among the more educated or religiously conservative members of the Black community, hoodoo might have been rejected or minimized in favor of Christian practices. In rural areas or among those who maintained stronger ties to African traditions, hoodoo was often still practiced as part of daily life and spiritual expression. Despite these tensions, it's important to note that many aspects of hoodoo persisted in Black churches, particularly in the form of syncretism, which means blending African traditions with Christianity. For instance, we have the use of saints in Catholicism and the reverence of spiritual figures in Black churches. They often mirrored practices from African spiritual traditions. The church might not have formally endorsed hoodoo, but elements of it were woven into the fabric of the community's religious experience. The rejection of hoodoo by Black churches stemmed from a mixture of theological concerns, cultural assimilation pressures, and the desire for social respectability, even though hoodoo remained deeply embedded in the lived experiences and the spiritual practices of many people, including those who attended those churches. So today, hoodoo is viewed in various ways depending on cultural, religious, and individual perspectives. It's experienced a resurgence in recent decades as people are increasingly exploring, and I would say they're reclaiming their spiritual and cultural heritage. However, there are still some tensions around hoodoo, particularly among certain religious communities and individuals, right? So I think we see that especially here. I say here in the South, I forget that I'm no longer in the South, but we see this a lot in what we call the South in the US. Many African Americans and others of African descent, they see hoodoo as a form of cultural reclamation and spiritual empowerment. As an African-American folk tradition, it's deeply tied to the history of slavery, oppression, and survival. For some, practicing hoodoo is a way to connect with their ancestral roots, and by doing so, they honor their history, and they reclaim a sense of self and identity outside of mainstream religious structures. This perspective views hoodoo as an important part of the African-American spiritual landscape and an expression of resilience and resistance. Hoodoo is still somewhat viewed with suspicion by organized religious groups, especially by Christian denominations. In particular, many Christian churches, both black and white, they continue to reject hoodoo, considering it incompatible with Christian teachings. Some see it as witchcraft. Of course, we hear that everywhere. They see it as witchcraft. They see it as sorcery, and they believe that it goes against the tenets of faith. This view in particular, it persists despite the fact that elements of hoodoo were historically integrated into African-American Christian practices, such as through prayers, blessings, and the use of symbols, etc. So amongst practitioners, there is a growing emphasis on respecting the traditions and practices of hoodoo, acknowledging its origins in African spiritual practices and its development in the context of slavery and African-American history. Some view hoodoo as part of a larger African diaspora spirituality, where the fusion of African religious beliefs with Christianity and other influences has created a very unique syncretic, I always forget how to pronounce this word, but I know what it means, syncretic tradition. There are debates within the community about how to best honor and preserve the authenticity of hoodoo while adopting them, right, or adapting them into present day. So today, hoodoo is viewed through many lenses. As a cultural practice, it's viewed as a spiritual system, magical tradition, or alternative wellness practice in some spaces. Its perceptions range from a proud form of African-American spiritual expression, even to a form of commercialized mysticism or appropriated magic. However, its historical roots, its cultural significance, and continued relevance in the lives of those who practice it continue to make it an important part of African-American heritage and spiritual identity. I hope that this has been an insightful look into the history of hoodoo. There was so much to read, explore, and what I decided to put in here, I already felt was quite a bit of information, even though there are wonderful books on very specific practitioners in the South, the history, especially during the Jim Crow era in the South, which is very insightful, but also really hard to read in many cases. But I wanted to touch on hoodoo, as there has been such a huge resurgence of this practice. But at the same time, from my perspective only, what I have seen is as people reclaim like their ancestral practices, it seems to be met with a lot of hostility from, let's just say, many Christian denominations. I'll put it that way, right? Even though, as I kind of indicated today, let's say and I'm using the term black churches, even though I am fully aware there are various denominations under that umbrella. However, there's still a lot of hostility, you know, if you practice something other than what is considered to be, yes, mainstream Christianity. I just heard this in my head as I'm talking against the mainstream, my guy just said. Yes, that is very correct. So I just wanted to give the history here because I think it's really helpful when we start to look at some of these practices and how they're beginning to, yeah, definitely emerge in modern day. There are a lot of questions as to who's allowed to practice and who's not allowed to practice. What's an open practice and what's a closed practice? Meaning like who's allowed to actually, I would say be initiated, but there's no initiation when it comes to hoodoo. However, it is deeply tied, as you see here, to enslaved African practices. blended with indigenous practices, blended with European practices. So it's very unique in that way. And a lot of the I'll use the word practices again, but a lot of the treatments, the healing treatments, right, protections, charms, etc., was given from generation to generation, orally, not necessarily written down, especially given that, the enslaved Africans were not allowed to learn how to read and write, even though some did in some cases, but not we don't find that often, right? So there are wonderful stories that you can look for online in various books. I will link the books that I used for this episode if you are very interested in more of the history. And if you're interested in voodoo from New Orleans or Louisiana as a whole, I'm sure many of you who are listening are very familiar with Marie Laveau. There are a million books written on her. And if you go to New Orleans, you will, come across several voodoo shops as well. That's not what this episode is about today, but I understand that when people hear hoodoo, they automatically think voodoo in New Orleans, especially. Everyone, again, hope this was insightful. I hope it was a good look into at least the history of hoodoo. So thank you for tuning in today, and until next time, everybody, try to stay connected to your intuition and to your roots if you can. Anywhere, take care, and we'll talk soon. Bye.